Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Mad About the Baron by Bianca Blythe, narrated by Angela Daw. Chapter 1. Grooms were not supposed to abandon their brides at altars, and nobody seemed less inclined to act ungallantly than the wondrous, utterly splendid Lord Bertrand Braunschweig, Baron of Volbert. Veronique Daventry, stepsister to the Duke of Alfriston, checked again that her train fanned dramatically behind her. The silk thread embroidered on the dress sparkled under the candlelight. Perfect. The vicar cleared his throat in a somber manner.
"Are you certain the groom is arriving, lassie?"
"He'll be here," Veronique said. One didn't write a woman that one intended to marry her and then not bother to make an appearance at the chapel. The vicar did not display the appropriate degree of confidence at the words, despite the frequency of Veronique's assertions. Never mind. A lack of timeliness was not the worst quality in a man. What were mere minutes compared to an eternity of love? Her momentary discomfort at the vicar's scrutiny would be more than worth it for the lifelong delight the Baron would experience at glimpsing her for the first time. Veronique had corresponded with Lord Braunschweig for 2 years, ever since he'd asked Mr. Simons for an introduction. No pleasure exceeded that of receiving a letter from him. She'd long memorized the exact sweep of his quill, the calligraphy often imperfect, as if he'd not been able to control his eagerness as he wrote her. The wind swept through the cracked stained glass windows, and the vicar placed a blanket over his legs. Veronique's neck was cold, as were her arms. The problem with sheer shimmering gowns that clung to one's body in an alluring fashion were that they were in no way designed for the frigid Scottish temperature. Catholics had been correct to insist on high collars and strategically placed vestments. Perhaps Veronique should have researched the elopement policies in France or Italy rather than Scotland. No matter. Maybe the man was lost. He was Austrian. He could be forgiven for being befuddled by the novel landscape of the Highlands. The poor Baron must be beside himself with agony. The vicar coughed, the noise amplified by the chapel's acoustics.
"When you wrote me to say you desired a wedding, I imagined you'd be bringing more people to witness the event than your maid."
"She is a good maid."
"Most women bring their family to such occasions, lassie. Surely you must be in possession of a single acquaintance."
She thought of her family, settled in Lord Rockport's parlour, blissfully unaware she was marrying a few yards away. Likely they were sipping tea and debating the merits of haggis. She wanted her first meeting with her future husband to be alone, and not in the presence of her loud-mouthed relations.
"Their company is not required."
The vicar scrutinized her.
"Your accent is foreign."
She shivered, but steeled her features. She refused to succumb to the faint doubt that threatened to appear whenever people examined her skin tone too closely, no matter how smugly their lips turned up when they decided they had an advantage over her. She would not allow this man, charged with ministering a small population in a remote mountainous village, to think himself superior to her. Tens of thousands of women adored her work.
"Your letters arrived from the former colonies,"
the vicar continued. But it was more of a question than a statement, and she turned away. The outline of Giever Castle, a grandiose compilation of steep walls and narrow turrets, loomed through the few window panes not graced with stained glass. Her stepsister Louisa had recently wed Lady Rockport's brother, and her stepmother had become so overcome with emotion that she'd succumbed to Veronique's pleas to accompany her family to the British Isles. She smiled. They'd be so delighted when she presented her new husband to them. Her stepmother frequently lamented the challenge of finding Veronique a fiancé, and she'd long dreamed of surprising them with a husband. Her skin tone might be unconventional, but that wouldn't stop her from romance. The vicar continued to direct a disapproving look in her direction, but she refused to yield to any unfounded misgivings he might have. Veronique addressed her maid.
"Please search for the Baron in the village."
"Very well, miss."
The girl dipped into a curtsy. "Tell him to hurry." Veronique glanced again at the vicar who stood near the candelabras, as if hopeful for warmth.
"The chapel is on a hill," the vicar said sternly. "It would be highly unlikely for the man to miss it. If he were to overlook so commanding and elegant a structure as this chapel, it might signify greater troubles in your marriage.
Veronique frowned. Her stepbrother was a duke. She was engaged to a baron. But more than that, she was wealthy and esteemed. Most people had heard of her, even if they were unfamiliar with her Christian name, and she summoned her most regal mannerism.
Is patience no longer a virtue to be lauded?
Well...
The man's face reddened, perhaps aided by a habit of sipping whiskey and wine. She shrugged. The Baron would arrive.
He needs to.
Chapter 2. Nothing in the world surpassed a carriage ride through the Scottish Highlands in utter intolerability. The constant, unpredictable swerve of the mail coach, coupled with the distinct lessening of interior standards compared to its English counterparts, rendered the experience insufferable. Miles thanked his ancestors for having the foresight to plant an estate in a more sensible region, Kent. The county's green hills never ventured into mountainous territory. Unfortunately, Miles's half-brother's ancestral line had shown considerable less foresight, which had led to Miles's current predicament. He strove to counteract the crisis by the most efficient means possible, feigning sleep. If he shut his eyes long enough, perhaps actual sleep would occur, even if the other travellers seemed intent on hampering that possibility, exclaiming with an overabundance of enthusiasm over every view composed of goats grasping onto soggy slopes with their hoofs. The passengers equaled him in Englishness. Clearly Scotsmen possessed too much sense to venture into one of these horrid contraptions. If only he could ride his favourite horse here. Yet he refused to submit Hercules to a long journey only to end in the icy gales and incessant sludge of the Highlands.
"Do you think that's him?"
A high-pitched voice squeaked with the vigour of a violin in the hands of a tone-deaf ABCDarian. Normally the shrill pitch might have discomfited him, though his mind was thoroughly occupied with her words.
"Whom do you mean?"
a second soprano voice asked.
"Why, Lord Worthing, naturally."
Blast.
He resisted the urge to open his eyes, or frown. It had happened. They'd discovered him. He'd thought he might be secure in Scotland. The war had ended 2 years ago, and he'd hoped people might have forgotten the depictions of him in heroic situations across the continent.
"It can't be him. I always supposed Lord Worthing to be tall."
Blood surged through Miles's veins.
"Now, ladies,"
a third female voice, gruffer and riddled with a sarcasm indicating a woman in belief of a possession of intelligence, said,
"He is sitting."
Perhaps this was their long-suffering mother, or virginal great-aunt.
"He is handsome,"
one of the women across him mused. Miles did not permit himself to smile. The chit had called him short. Forgiveness was not a state to be entered lightly.
"Though I did imagine his hair to be nicer,"
she continued. Some statements were intolerable. Miles clenched his fingers, inhaled, and opened his eyes. There were three of them. A plain-faced woman beside him, the severity of her face not lessened by her tightly pulled-back knot, and two other women opposite him, attired in bright Scottish tartan. The garish fabric was the sort no actual Scotswomen would parade about in, but which some women in possession of an abundance of money, not bestowed with a similar abundance of sense, allowed their dressmakers to persuade them to buy.
"I am indeed Lord Worthing,"
he declared, appreciating how their eyes widened and took on a familiar dewy expression that tended to occur right before certain chits dropped their handkerchiefs.
"How exciting,"
the woman beside him said, creasing her grey dress as she leaned closer. Definitely not a married woman. No man would tie himself to a creature so lacking in fashion sense. Likely she was a governess or a poor relative tasked to be the companion to children with whom the parents could not fathom conversing.
"It is most unfair to judge my hair when it is pouring outside."
He firmed his demeanour, summoning the aristocratic outrage his ancestors must have faced when confronted with the Normans' invasion.
"Even Brummel himself couldn't help but have his coiffure look inelegantly tousled."
The chits should have looked ashamed. That was the natural reaction to being chastised. Instead, they beamed, the fact highlighted by their generous application of vermilion.
It's truly you.
Naturally.
Thank you, heavens!
The chit opposite him shouted, flinging her nondescript brown curls to the side. Her sister, judging from the similar hair shade, refrained from speaking, though she did clap. Loudly. He eyed them warily. This was no time for joy. He drew himself up, emphasizing the length of his torso when he was not occupied with attempting sleep, and directed his loftiest stare at them.
No one could feign my appearance.
They had the audacity to giggle, and Miles scowled.
We were thinking you might be here,
the first chit confided.
Why ever would you think that?
Horror surged through him. This was Scotland, not a battlefield, not a war-tattered town, not even Mayfair. He didn't desire to get the reputation of a man who frequented this dismal land. There was no war for him to report on, only brownish grassland gorged with goats, and perhaps one anonymous authoress.
Your half-brother lives near here, Lord Rockport,
she added, as if he might have forgotten the name. Miles crossed his arms.
We were hopeful you might be visiting,
she continued.
And here you are.
How nice for you,
he said.
Yes,
the woman across from him assented.
We've been in Scotland for months, but this will make everyone most jealous.
An emotion important to spread.
He waited for their faces to pale, but they blinked up at him, their faces still adorned with unwavering smiles.
You are one of my charge's favourite celebrities, the woman beside him confided. They've expressed admiration for the chiselled features of your face.
Miles relaxed slightly. His features were impeccable. Maintaining a stony expression was more challenging than he'd assumed. He wondered at his tutor's ability to emanate arrogance with unflappable consistency, though then again, likely they had never been subjected to such blatant flattery. Still, he could not reward the women with conversation for being in possession of eyesight, and he refrained from gracing them with a smile. They still hadn't mentioned his actual accomplishments, ones that surpassed even his ability to maintain a modicum of suavity. There had once been a time when he'd travelled around Europe, evading cavalry charges and blue-garbed Frenchmen brandishing muskets. That had been a bloody good time. He hadn't fought, but he'd done something better. He'd reported the news to the world. Now there was no war. Bonaparte had capitulated, and Miles was back in Britain. His editor had assigned him to find a woman calling herself Loretta Van Locken. It was a hard fall. Such frivolities held no interest to him. Unfortunately, her undeniable fame interested his publisher, who desired to expand the newspaper's female readership. If only the English government possessed less skill at diplomacy, and he might visit a region which was not habituated mainly by livestock. Miles was famous for reporting in the midst of danger, but not for writing about novelists, particularly of penny dreadfuls.
Since we are acquainted with your name, the woman beside him said, interrupting him from his gloomy musings, I must take it upon myself to introduce myself, and my charges, to you.
Miles frowned. He favored resuming an attempt at sleep.
I am Miss Hesper Haskett.
She lingered on her salutation, emphasizing her unmarried status, as if urging him to change it.
I see,
Miles replied icily. Etiquette might dictate that he should express some pleasure at meeting her, but he'd never been one for propriety, especially for people who questioned his attractiveness.
These are my charges, Miss Theodosia Fitzroy and Miss Amaryllis Fitzroy.
Our parents didn't want us to travel in the same carriage as them,
Miss Amaryllis Fitzroy said gaily.
Apparently we are quite talkative.
Miles composed his face into the sort of stern expression his father had never possessed, choosing instead to channel the austere gaze of his instructors. There had to be some advantages to attending Eton beyond the memorization of Virgil. Miss Haskett continued to stare at him, and unease trickled through Miles. Did Miss Haskett's scrutiny need to be so unwavering? Miles was certain there had once been greater space between them, not that the coach could be described as expansive. Perhaps the Scottish owners had decided to economize, or perhaps the Scottish were narrower-hipped than their English counterparts, owing to the prevalence of inedible dishes such as haggis and black pudding. Miss Haskett's charges still seemed affected by his presence, judging from their glazed eyes. Miles directed his vision downward. Perhaps pushing his arms against his chest emphasized the broadness of said chest or the muscular form of his arms. Indeed, some women might even find his stony expression appealing, bequeathing him with mystery.
The coach driver informed us there will be another stop before we reach the coast.
Miss Haskett gazed meaningfully at him.
Wouldn't it be pleasant to partake in some repast at the posting inn?
Well...
Miles was hungry, not that he would confide that to Miss Haskett.
We can all dine together!
Miss Theodosia Fitzroy clapped her hands.
Lord Worthing is a baron, Miss Haskett replied. He is a man of much importance and may be reluctant to dine with ladies who have not even debuted yet.
Oh!
The chit's gleeful expressions rearranged themselves to something resembling devastation.
Though, perhaps...
Miss Haskett leaned nearer him, and a thick floral scent invaded his nostrils. There could be no earthly reason for the scent of roses to be quite so potent in this tiny carriage, all the way in the Highlands in the middle of January. She tossed her head.
The Baron likely favours dining with me.
As a matter of fact...
Miles doubted the propriety of having the gap between them be so thoroughly narrowed and edged nearer the window.
You can regale me with stories of your adventures.
Well...
He strove to find an excuse to dine alone.
Do you not adore posting inns? Miss Haskett remarked. Especially in this region. They are always so... empty.
Miles firmed his expression. Thank goodness for gloves. No need for anyone to see blood rushing to his wrists before he clenched them. He knew what this woman desired. She wanted him to take her to such a room, and then be discovered by her charges. He scowled. He refused to be compromised. That was something that happened to other aristocrats. He was a former war correspondent. Perhaps now there was no use for him to work abroad, but one day there would be. The chits chattered on, and eventually the coach slowed and pulled into the posting inn.
Finally!
The ladies scuttled down the steep, screeching steps of the carriage, swishing their pelisses over his boots, their faces still grinning, as if they desired to tell everyone that they'd come close to touching. Miss Haskett extended a gloved hand in his direction, and Miles's stomach constricted as her fingers tightened around his. He helped her to her feet, and her eyelashes batted with a rapidity warranted for confronting a dust storm.
Thank you, Lord Worthing.
Yes.
He scrambled from the carriage, and his spine stiffened as the carriage steps squeaked behind him.
Shall we dine?
Miss Haskett's voice seemed to have dropped an octave. Ever since a certain matchmaking for wallflowers article, all the ladies had taken to lowering their voices in an effort at seduction. Miles did not want to be seduced. Not now, not ever. He was cold and wet and hungry. The Scottish gales swirled with an unrelenting gusto, as if desiring praise for their blustering puissance. Patches of snow melted over the soggy mud, and the posting inn, hunched over a steep slope, scarcely inspired confidence. Miles trudged toward the half-timbered structure, noting how the thatched roof sagged under some not-yet-melting snow. Hopefully they'd managed to learn how to pour ale into a tankard and make a decent meat pie. The inn looked like it had had sufficient centuries to practice. Miss Haskett entered the inn before him, joining her charges. His nose pinched in the cold, and a cloud of grey smoke spurted with every breath, perhaps to assure him he'd not frozen, yet. They disappeared around a corner after ordering, and Miles approached the barmaid. Her lips seemed to curl.
This way, sir. There's a fire in the room. You'll be warm in no time.
The words seemed to make her eyes sparkle. Clearly, Scots had very little to amuse themselves, or perhaps she'd simply never seen a person so clearly in need of warmth before. He frowned. Perhaps he hadn't needed to arrive at Gerard's in a tweed coat, even though his tailor had insisted it was the very latest in fashion. Perhaps he might even have selected a cravat fabric that better protected his neck against the cold. But still, surely that alone shouldn't be cause for merriment. Was the woman able to tell from his mere stride that he did not belong in this vile country? He sighed. Perhaps. After all, he was very English. His ancestors may have settled in Kent, but they'd made the move from Sussex. His ancestors had married some Norman aristocrats, ones who, when not occupying themselves with invading, used a modicum of manners learned from their time on the continent.
"Shouldn't I order?"
She laughed.
"There's only one meal here, Lord Worthing."
Evidently Scotland received broadsheets too. He'd been a bloody good correspondent.
"This way," she said briskly. "I know just where to seat you."
He followed her past some tables, noting the driver mingling with some locals. The barmaid's gate did not waver, and she opened a door. He ducked under the low wooden beam and took a seat.
"I'll bring you your grub now."
"Thank you."
The door clicked behind him as she exited, and he frowned, and then shrugged. Some people were taken aback to be so near to the presence of a person so important. Miles had never been asked for directions so much since becoming famous, and he was accustomed to young women approaching and giggling as they inquired about the location of Westminster Abbey or St. Paul's Cathedral, when any fool could spot the spires soaring above the other city buildings. He glanced around the dimly lit room. He had the strange sensation that he was being observed, even though the barmaid had just left.
"We are alone," a feminine voice sounded behind him, and his heart sank. He turned around and braced himself. Miss Haskett stood before him. His eyebrows rose. He'd always assumed governesses to value rules, given their proclivity to occupy the greater portion of their time in trying to impart order to others.
"I told my charges to give us privacy."
Miss Haskett flung her hair, and her straight locks tumbled inelegantly downward. She strode toward him, and for a horrible second he wondered whether she might plop herself on his lap to better be available for admiration. The woman seemed to have found time to change. She'd replaced her somber grey frock for a slightly more vivacious dark blue. Two rows of pearls dangled from her neck. The jewels were of such a grandiose size that he wondered if she'd taken the necklace from one of her charges. A gasp seemed to sound inside the room. He scrutinized the shadowed sections of the room, the places that the single tallow candle did not reach. Was it possible someone was hiding behind one of the centuries-old pillars?
"Baron," Miss Haskett said quickly.
"You shouldn't be here,"
Miles said.
"How pleasant to find you worry about me."
He swallowed hard.
"If anyone found you here..."
Marriage. That was the sort of thing that might happen. He'd had sufficient chits place themselves in his paths and start undressing. They tended to have scheming mamas or financially desperate papas. He knew friends who'd been felled by these manipulations. His old friend Toppy was never at his London club, tasked with producing sufficient heirs and spares to give his new wife, whom he'd found undressed behind a balcony curtain shortly before her loud-mouthed mamma happened upon them. Lord Markham, a man who'd never expressed much interest in women and had a rumoured preference for certain Soho Molly houses, had been caught with a woman in a maze at a house party. Lord Markham did not seem to be the type to succumb to such passions, and the poor man must be miserable, ensconced with his new wife and parents-in-law in a dilapidating manor house in Cornwall. Lord Worthing directed his attention to Miss Haskett.
"Please leave."
Uncertainty flickered over her face, but she inhaled.
"And waste this opportunity?"
She seemed to be striving to lower a capped sleeve down her shoulder, and she frowned as her hands yanked the fabric.
"In truth,"
Lord Worthing said, forcing his tone to sound apologetic and gentlemanly,
"I just want to eat."
"Me?"
Her face flushed, but she managed to retain eye contact with him. He had to admire her for that. And then he heard something that sounded like shuffling. Something that sounded very much like shuffling.
Blast.
He had to leave. At any moment, somebody might pop from behind a column. He sprinted for the door.
"I see you!"
A high-pitched voice, perhaps Amaryllis, shouted behind him. But she was too late. He would not allow anyone to compromise him. He enjoyed his life. He enjoyed his bachelor ways and refused to be saddled with a wife, no matter her cleverness at concocting compromising situations. He rushed through the pub and grabbed a piece of bread some guest had left behind.
"Don't bother with the meal,"
he gasped to the barmaid as he gobbled the too stale roll. He pushed open the door and rushed over the damp grass and patches of snow toward the coach. A groom was supervising the switching of horses.
"'Will be a while before you can go,'
the man said.
"'I want to ride the rest of the way myself.'
The coach driver narrowed his eyes.
"'On these roads?
What are a few holes?'
Miles attempted to smile brightly. He was a good rider. He would certainly be able to do anything that a Scottish farmer had to do on occasion. Even if the drizzle didn't seem exactly pleasant, and even if the heaps of melting snow and sludge did not seem enticing.
"'I rather fancy the quiet,'
Miles said.
"'Aye,'
the coach driver nodded.
"'You'll find that here. Reckon you can't find much quiet in London with all those society parties.'
He winked.
"'Don't think I don't recognize you.'
"'Does everyone?'
Miles asked faintly. Normally he would be proud of his carefully cultivated reputation, but now the path to his brother's castle seemed of the unpleasant variety.
"'One moment!'
The coachman scrambled to his seat and found a spare sheet of paper amongst more official-looking documents and maps. He picked up a quill and quickly dipped it into ink so it dripped onto the paper.
"'Care to make an autograph for my son?'
"'Naturally.'
Miles asked him his son's name and addressed it. The door to the public house swung open, and Miss Haskett stepped outside. She strode directly toward him, her two charges in tow. Miles scribbled his signature hastily.
"'I really must go.'
He took one of the horses that was being lined up.
"'How much to borrow this one?'
"'But that's something you should arrange with the groomsman here,'
the coach driver shouted.
"'No time,'
Miles said hastily, and threw some notes at the coachman.
"'You arrange it.'
The man glanced at the money.
"'But that's more than enough to buy the horse.'
Miles grinned.
"'Good.'
He swung onto the startled horse and urged it to a gallop. It was unfortunate he hadn't had time to have a proper saddle put on the horse, but it didn't matter. Miles excelled at horse riding, even if riding through Scotland on the type of frigid day that should be devoted purely to hot chocolate drinking was suboptimal. He inhaled the crisp air and guided the horse through the smattering of thatched-roofed homes that made up the village. The horse's hooves clopped a happy rhythm over the path, and Miles guided it in the direction of the castle. Soon he would see his family, but now he could enjoy freedom from the carriage and its occupants, even if the rain had turned into the freezing variety. Miles urged his horse forward, and it galloped over the ever rockier terrain. Raindrops scattered over him, obscuring the tall brown slopes the Scots tended to extol. Chapter 3 The rain increased, and Miles almost regretted his athletic urge to arrive on horseback. Coaches had their advantages, even if they did have a propensity to be filled with the more scheming of the other sex.
Blast.
He'd rather expected to appear in more style than sweeping his muddied boots and water-soaked cloak about Gerard's castle. Rain tumbled down on him as he neared Giovercastel, and Miles sympathized with the sour expressions that graced his Scottish counterparts with the regularity of smiles on the English. One likely wouldn't take an optimistic outlook on the world after tramping about in soggy clothes one's whole life. Giovercastel adorned a steep cliff that towered over the ocean. Perhaps the castle's location had been selected to ward off invaders, but whichever long-dead laird had forced his subjects to construct the unsymmetrical compilation of turrets and towers had not needed to bother. Miles was certain that no one, no matter how desperate, would want anything to do with this region. Even Vikings, who had the misfortune of being born in Denmark, or worse yet, Norway, had preferred to pillage the area in the summer and row the long journey back than attempt to live here. Miles guided his horse into the hamlet, thankful he recalled the way. One would think that after existing for so many centuries it would have occurred to someone to make a good sign. Then again, visitors were likely an abstract concept for the inhabitants. Stone cottages were scattered over hills so steep he wondered how anyone managed to walk here, much less live with any degree of permanency. The homes seemed to mirror the crumbling Hadrian's Wall he'd crossed on the way to this blasted country. Narrow windows, the small size chosen perhaps to lessen the incessant chill or simply out of exasperation of ever seeing anything resembling proper sunlight shine through them, dotted the buildings at wide intervals. If Miles were his older brother, he would live anywhere else. Apartments in Paris were more advantageous, and Miles possessed sufficient pride of his English heritage and outrage over the French conduct during the Napoleonic Wars to not mull over such alternatives lightly. A few locals peered at him with suspicion. He wondered whether they could sense his Englishness. Likely he needed to scowl more vigorously to blend in.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?